historically splendid abodes, the official podcast of Toronto Philippe. Exploring, if you will, practical philosophy, from science and the workings of the mind to spirituality, esotericism, and magic. Stooping down, dipping my wings, I came to the darkly splendid abodes. Liber Resh Vel Helios is a Thelemic ritual adoration of the sun, performed at the four stations of dawn, midday, sunset, and midnight. It is used as a regular invocation of god forms and as a mindfulness practice by Thelemites the world over. Edward Mason and I will chat about this staple Thelemic practice. Do what thou wilt shall be the hold of the law.
Love is the law. Love and the will.
Welcome back, and we are beginning season five, even though it's only been... This is the completion of our third year and the beginning of the fourth. But we're in season five.
Heavens!
And today,
celebrate by talking about things.
Yeah, we'll talk about the sun's transition through the sky, which seems appropriate. We'll be talking about Liber Resh today, which is one of those subjects that's so profoundly basic and rudimentary, I think, in the mind of somebody who's been spending time in Thelema, that it's easy to underestimate or overlook. And I'm sure generally people who start some kind of a YouTube video series or podcast are going to start with that as one of the many things you can explain to people, because they don't have time to read over one sheet. But yeah, I thought, you know, somebody had asked about it in the comments somewhere, and I thought, you know what, I'm sure we could probably unpack some stuff from it and get something out of a little bit of a look at it. So,
and if we mislead everybody, well, at least we'll have some fun, right?
Exactly.
Okay. So, Liber Resh, that's the letter of the Hebrew alphabet, which on the Tree of Life is assigned to the path given to the sun card, hence the name in the book of Resh, because Resh actually means the head or the front of the head, and doesn't have any direct connection, so far as I've ever found out, with the Hebrew language words for the sun.
Mm-hmm.
That's Liber 200, Liber CC, because that's 200 in Latin. And in Liber Abba, the book four, which is all of the instructions on how to do everything, and I'm sure we all have a copy of that tucked away somewhere, even if it never gets opened. It's one of the official instructions for the AA, not for the OTO. It's published, so anybody can start practicing it. But it is obviously designed to be one of the things that kickstarts people on the AA path to Thelemic illumination. So we've got this thing, and just reading the text from Liber Abba, these are the adorations to be performed by all aspirants to the AA. Let him greet the sun at dawn, facing east, giving the sign of his grade. And if you don't have a grade in the AA at this point, there's still, the book gives you the signs you can use. And let him say in a loud voice, "Hail unto thee who art." And then it depends what time of day. There's a different god for dawn, lunchtime, evening or sunset, and midnight, mm-hmm. which is your first problem, because not all of us get up at dawn, or if we do, we're not actually capable of doing anything for the next 15 minutes until there's been sufficient caffeine flowing through our veins. Mm-hmm. Not all of us stay up till midnight. And, of course, sunset comes at all kinds of odd hours of the evening. If you live really far north in the Northern Hemisphere, say in Scotland or Northern Canada, you know, that could be 10 o'clock at night, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the first thing you have to do is set up your own routine. Why are you doing it anyway? And that's, I think, one of the more interesting aspects of Rishwa. Like, what is it we're really getting at here? First of all, it is intended to give us a certain amount of discipline. Crowley says in his comment here, it's an instruction for adoration of the sun four times daily with the object of composing the mind to meditation and of regularizing the practices. In other words, you come in, you don't know what you're going to be doing in all of this thelemic magic and mysticism, but here's somebody saying, well, you've got to train your mind to do all kinds of stuff right through the day. It's not a Sunday religion. It's not a just before bedtime religion. It's a religion you are creating for yourself that it comes up all of these different times, some of which are fairly easy. I never found it difficult to do the dawn one, you know, whenever, but I made dawn whenever I got up, because sometimes in winter in Toronto, I would be getting up 45 minutes before dawn. And if I waited for dawn, I should really be, you know, skedaddling out of the door. Similarly, I was always in bed well before midnight, so I had to make an adjustment there. Finally, I followed the late Jerry Cornelius suggestions, which was just look, set up something that is regular. If you go to bed at 10:30 at night, fine. 10:25, you do your midnight resh. That is your personal midnight. You're shutting down for the night and going into an altered state of unconsciousness or unconsciousness. The one I always had the worst difficulty with was the noonday one, Hail unto thee who art Hathor and thy triumphing. Mm-hmm. Because I was at work, and often there would be a lunch invitation, or maybe work just took me past the noon point, or I might come back because of summertime. I'd have started work again after lunch because noon was sometime after 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And that meant that I struggled with that one. Mm-hmm. As you know, a lot of us, you know, have the great secret that the place we can do noon resh is to find the office or factory bathroom and go in the cubicle, mutter it silently, holding our fingers up to our foreheads. And so many Thelemites have consecrated many washrooms across the world in the past century. So that's the first thing you have to do. You've got to get the discipline. But then there's the question, okay, I'm now disciplined for what? What exactly is it I'm after? And it struck me thinking about this, that first of all, I think all of us come into Thelema with a set of interconnected ideas about what we want to do. We want to improve ourselves. We want to improve our lives. We want to have a better understanding or insight or wisdom or an amazing, mind-blowing, mystical revelation. Therefore, we come in with fixed ideas. You find if you're talking more with people who are into the Asian-derived mysticisms of our time, various forms of Buddhism, Vedanta, and so on, they're always going on about the ego, which is a rather poor word to describe all of the structures and compulsive agreements we have in our own minds about how things ought to be, how things are, how things ought to become. You know, it's all fixed stuff. Liberesh is a devotional exercise, and devotion has this extraordinary ability to start breaking down fixed, intellectually formulated concepts. And I think if it does anything, it annoys all of us enough that we start beginning to let go of a lot of those fixed ideas so we can start to get an appreciation for how to approach the sacred, whatever that conception is to begin with, because obviously as you go through the Thelemic systems, your concept of the sacred, the divine, whatever generic title you begin with, is going to shift quite radically. Sometimes it becomes very theistic. Sometimes it becomes very specifically Horusian. And other times it sort of goes into a much more generalized field of enlightened awareness. But it will move around a lot, and you shouldn't stay stuck on one thing.
That makes I was thinking about asking what your thoughts are on people sort of innovating Resh with their own sticking their own god forms into it and that sort of thing, because that makes it sound like that might defeat the purpose to some extent.
I suppose when you've been doing things for a few years, you could try that, certainly. I never have, I don't think. Mm-hmm. I hated the exercise to begin with. It just annoyed the hell out of me. Not just the scheduling thing, but conceptually, it seemed to be something far too specific in its theistic orientation. I was still a kind of crypto-Buddhist when I came into Thelema. Mm-hmm. And therefore, it was a bit too Abrahamic. Mm-hmm. Even though this was all variations on Rahu or Kuit, you know, it's the sun, which is Horus, which is, you know, all of that.
Yeah, it should be said that it's like very Islamic. It's very much, you know, I would believe, inspired by the call to prayer kind of thing.
The calls to prayer, definitely. And it just didn't click for me. So it was nonetheless breaking down some of my fixed ideas. And after I've been doing things for a while, I began to think, okay, this is beginning to shift my perspectives, which of course is what I wanted out of Thelemic practice. And I had a better appreciation for it. I think probably I personally drifted to other rituals because they seem to give more of an immediate kick and have more of an effect of breaking down those fixed ideas for me. But liberation set the tone of the thing. It was something I could share with people. And you end up, if you learn liberation properly, how to do it with a whole bunch of people at sunset or noon if you get together with other Thelemites. One time I was in New York City with about 15 people and we all said it as loudly as possible as we could on a rooftop. And I'm sure that we shook all of Brooklyn at the time when we did it. Anyway, it was just a fun thing to do. And of course, that's the other thing you learn from this. There's a fun aspect. It is not telling us how we have to repent because we're bad. It's celebrating the fact that we can become much bigger and wider and wiser and grander and cuter than we have had before. And that's, I think, one of the main benefits I had from it. There's also a, let's scare people aspect. Crowley says in the instructions, you know, and let him say in a loud voice, hail unto thee who art, you know, whichever deity it is. And of course, people I find think, well, I mustn't be seen doing this. I mustn't be heard because, well, really, you think people will look at you as if you're crazy. One time I was in Toronto, and it was the summer, and I realized it was time for Resh because I'd only been initiated 2 months before. I thought, there's nowhere around here that I can, I was right downtown. There's nowhere I can go to say this in private. Couldn't think whether it was a public washroom. So I thought, well, what happens if I do this on the street? And this was not Yonge Street, but just one of the streets just off it with lots of people passing by. And I just thought, well, I'll stand there and say this in a normal voice. And of course, everybody thought, crazy guy, and walked straight past me and ignored me. Nobody interfered. Nobody was bothered. They just wanted to make sure they didn't have to have any contact with me and I didn't ask them for 50 cents for a coffee or something. That was a lesson. Like, nobody cares. Say this thing wherever you want. Not that long after, I was in a different town with another Thelemite who was saying, we should say evening Resh. And I said, yes, we should. And she said to me, where do we go where no one hears us? And I said to her these dreadful words, nobody cares. And so we stood at the side of a grassed area near a fairly busy part of the town. And I just started proclaiming this with my arms out in the, I think it's the 2-9 sign of AA. And she was sort of like terrified that we were going to get arrested by the you know, the ethics police or something. Finally, of course, ended up laughing because nobody had paid the slightest amount of attention to these two crazy people who were yelling something in the general direction of the setting sun. So it's something that can help you get through the absurdities of bourgeois life simply because you have to say it. And there are stories of Crowley getting up to say it on top of a London bus. You know, so you don't have to be secret about it. It's a publicly acknowledged ritual. It's published to the world. So that's a key thing as well, I think, just learning to own your own intention. You don't have to explain it to anybody because nobody's going to pay the slightest attention to a lunatic saying things, staring into the distance. So you're absolutely immune from public interference. Important to remember that one.
Yeah, the best way to make sure nobody's paying attention to you, I think, in Toronto at least, is to try and do everything to get attention.
Yes, exactly. You just need to avoid being too shy about things. Then people think you're hiding a mystery and they want to know what's going on. One other thing that occurred to me about this that is a bit of a mystery. The wording of Resh is standard. That was published. The instructions say, and after each of these invocations, Ra, Hathor, Tum, and Kephra, thou shalt give the sign of silence, and afterward thou shalt perform the adoration that is taught thee by thy superior. Mm-hmm. And then do thou compose thyself to holy meditation. Now, the adoration is not specified here. The only version that I'm aware of is the one that came down to us through Jane Wolfe and her students, which is the bit of the adorations in chapter 3 of the Book of the Law. Unity uttermost showed, I adore the might of thy breath, supreme and terrible God. We don't use the very last verse of that adoration, but we use most of it. This is the thing that Crowley produced from the back of the Stele of Revealing. Now, if you read the translations of that, it's not hard to see that he was very creative before he actually received the dictation of the Book of the Law. He came up with something that obviously fit with Golden Dawn teachings that he'd received before. And created what he thought would work. And then when the dictation happened, he was told to include those adorations that, you know, thou hast already come up with. So that is the one we use, but I have no idea whether somebody else out there, in fact, received a different instruction. And possibly the ritual evolved slightly over the years. I think it's in Moonchild, there's a version of Resh given that is very slightly different from what we have as the published version today. And it doesn't mention the adorations, if I remember correctly. So perhaps they were doing it slightly differently when he first came up with this ritual. So it has been improved and expanded somewhat over the years since it first came into existence. Mm-hmm. Other thing, of course, is the compose thyself to holy meditation. And I can remember thinking very grumpily, that's all very well if you don't have to get to work by 9 a.m. Or you're, you know, occupying a bathroom, and bathrooms might be okay for standing there and saying the adoration, but trying to meditate, they don't have a conducive atmosphere. So that was a tricky one. If you can get away from other people into a corner of the lunchroom or one bit of the park over at the edge, if there's a park near where you work, then that's absolutely fine. Otherwise, you're a bit stuck. And I confess, I confess my deep shame that most of the time it was more a quick acknowledgement of, you know, I'll do something later when I'm able to. So in the evening when I was at home saying the sunset resh or my just before bedtime version, yes, I could take some time to meditate. Mm-hmm. But then there's the question, what is it you're meditating on? Mm-hmm. Which presumably is what you just said in the recitation of resh and the adorations that follow. You're not really supposed to be meditating on the different levels of the Kabbalistic tree of life, or, you know, the sequence of chakras down the spine. That's not the material that you're working with here. This is about an appreciation of the fact that Resh is giving you some sense of the sacredness within your own being. Specifically, it pertains to Horus as a sun god in that, you know, in that particular guise for him. And there's getting into that a bit and letting that idea speak to you. And of course, if you've done the thing right, and this is not in the instructions, but most people will adopt the god form of the deity, so that you are a falcon at dawn, you are the cow-headed goddess of love at noon, you are that guy standing there holding up the heavens as tomb at sunset, and at midnight you are Kephra, as the beetle holding up the sphere as you push it onward through the darkness of the Duat. So there's an awful lot there to pull out and consider. There's a lot of seed ideas that are planted performing this thing. As I say, I always argued with it, perhaps because I simply didn't appreciate what was there at the time. But there's a tremendous amount you can begin to establish for your own future practice with this.
Do you find that over the years, have you innovated the practice at all?
No, if I've ever used it, it's because I feel I've got a bit off track. You know, I'm just kind of blundering around in one of those, oh, I had a fabulous realization last month, but really it was not quite as cool an idea as I thought it was. It just doesn't lead anywhere. And I need to pull myself back onto my main path. And I've always, for that reason, uttered Resh specifically the way Crowley wrote it. I have not switched around deities, even though I always have an argument because Kephra is actually the deity of dawn. He's the guy who lifts up the dawning sun. He's not the one who carries it through the night. And Hathor is associated with the beauty of the day, but she's not really got a strong association with the movement. The sun is kind of paused at noon, but that's not really her thing. Tum, likewise, which is, of course, Atum, rendered in Golden Dawnese, he doesn't have a strong solar association either. It was really Ra and Kephra who are the two of those deities who specifically fit solar devotional work. So, no, I've resisted the temptation simply because I was using Resh specifically to get back into the main track and then, you know, pick up the current again and get my grade work back in line and moving along in a more satisfactory direction. I'm taking it from your questions that maybe you've played around with that a bit.
Well, I mean, yeah, I like that you can sense the the chomping at the bit to share ideas. But rather than just jumping into that, I wanted to point out, like, one of the things that comes to mind or that I've noticed over time is in the book HHH, Liber HHH, it's like basically three different meditations and sort of like guided meditations. And the first one, I believe, well, one of them has this portion of it that involves visualing oneself as the orb of the sun setting on the back of a cow and then traveling through midnight with the sound of a beetle in the darkness and that sort of thing, and then rising. Is it rising with the scream of a hawk, or is it at midday with I forget exactly. I don't have it completely clear in my mind, but that makes me wonder, because it's so similar to Liber Resh, but with a slight different variation on the attributions.
I think Crowley found that Liber Resh was very helpful for himself, and therefore what you're talking about, which I admit I haven't read for a slight period of time, worked for him. And yes, the visualizing yourself in that way tends to set up certain unconscious associations that we can exploit. One thing here that occurred to me looking at this, that pretty much every ritual you're going to do, whether we're talking about the lesser ritual of the pentagram or the hexagram, whether we're talking about the star ruby or the star sapphire, it's always these four points of orientation, as well as the above and the below, that are the things that orient us in our own personal astral temple. That is where you locate yourself, and it gives you something within which you can center yourself. Mm-hmm. And that continues right through something like Liba Samek, which is probably the most strenuous ritual Crowley ever came up with, that you're still getting the four gates of the four directions lined up before you align with spirit and try and open fully to the HGA. So it's training in that concept. This is your orientation. A lot of religions just look to the east because that's the rising sun place. That's more, Islam is very much about that. You're always oriented towards the Qibla there in Mecca. Other people, I think, I'm just trying to remember which school of Buddhism has the eight directions, and I can't at the moment, but they are much more picky. They've got the northeast and northwest and stuff. And of course, you find that in the Golden Dawn rituals in their temple. They had the four sons of Horus in the corners of their rectangular temples. But it is training you towards that idea of initially a cube, but also just simply an orientation where you are putting yourself at the center of things, ultimately the absolute center, which is the point where the illumination, the gnosis, the revelation begins to open out from the heart. And I think that is one of the critical things that it tends towards, without spilling that out and saying, hey, you've got to do this, this is what is required. It's something that arises in its own time, in its own way.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of, I've certainly heard said that like one way to think of Libra Resh is that it's, you're identifying instead of with the point of view of the earth, you're identifying with the point of view of the sun instead.
And yes, you are. You're setting, you're putting yourself, by adopting those God forms, you are setting yourself outside of the earth in one sense, but also since we are dealing with sunrise, noon, sunset, and midnight, that is also a terrestrial viewpoint because it's how it's seen from the earth. Mm-hmm. So it blurs one into the other. It's useful for both. One is saying, hey, you are here on earth. That's okay. Find your true will and things will go swimmingly, hopefully. Mm-hmm. And the other one is saying we are not just creatures of this earth, but also we are cosmic creatures, and identification with the sun is a key thing, because instead of having a God who is above and us as the groveling humans down on the earth, the whole thing about this aeon is an identification with the divine within each of us. And that means that we are going to put ourselves outside of the sphere of human affairs to a certain extent. Because we know we're going through this horribly destructive phase of one aeon packing up and going to permanent sleep, and the other aeon unfolding itself with a lot of upheavals and a lot of difficulties, shall we say.
Yeah. One of the things I've found from the identification with the sun through Resh is like in times when I'll be, dealing with a lot of anxiety in my own life and that sort of thing, and it might even feel like I don't want to do Resh because I'm absorbed in all these things, even just mundane things. By identifying with the sun, it's kind of a nice reminder that it's like, well, you know, even beyond the clouds, the sun is unaffected by anything on the earth. So it's completely doesn't experience any of the things that we experience in our day-to-day life. So it's that sort of sense of, well, the sun will come up tomorrow.
Yes.
And that ultimately the sorrows are as shadows, they pass and are done, but there's that which remains.
But the shadows come, and one of the things I've learned is that there's all kinds of stuff we hate. Mm-hmm. And I think that thelemic training tends to bring that out. There's a line in Liber Samech that has fascinated me for years. Thou didst form men to love one another and to hate one another. And this is in the original from about 15 centuries ago, this original Greco-Egyptian manuscript that the Golden Dawn found, the Bornless Ritual, and that they came up with a slightly edited version of that, which Crowley then turned into Liber Samech. But his comment on that, I don't have it in front of me, something about this is all, you know, it's all about relations between us and other people, which is what it shows us our own soul. That's not his exact wording, but it's the essence of what he's talking about. I don't know another religion or religious philosophy that really has embraced that idea as well as Thelema has, that you are here to say, okay, I can't stand this exercise, or so-and-so in my lodge or temple is a blankety-blankety-blank. Okay, what's that about? There's a part of yourself here that's scratching at and irritating, and you have to come to terms with that, because that's a critical thing, simply because the divine is such a force that those structures in the mind, they don't like it. It is far too much. The mind has a way of interpreting certain kinds of profound energy in the only way it knows how, which is to try to defend against them. That is, you know, I hate you. I resent you. I hate this ritual. It annoys the hell out of me. Eventually, you know, a fully illumined person, you know, when we all become a Marcus or something, they will begin to realize that it was always just something in their own mind that needed to be sidelined or ideally dissolved. But there is always that thing of what that which I resent is the thing that is going to teach me right now what might be my next step forward. Mm-hmm. So I think that my own resentment of Liber Reish was something that took me years to figure out until I finally got much more comfortably into devotional work as a regular part of practice and had got rid of some of my more neurotic hang-ups about, you know, that means I'm worshiping a god and gods are mean and nasty. Because gods tend to be mean and nasty. I mean, that's almost a definition of any deity humanity has ever had. You know, you're wonderful, you're marvelous, you're the divine, the gracious, the merciful, and sometimes you do horrible stuff. And of course, realizing that all of the forms of all of the gods are projections of deep things within ourselves is a very difficult thing to realize. You can get the idea, somebody can tell you that and think, yeah, I read some Carl Jung as well. But actually getting to that point where you can appreciate the fact that there are things in ourselves that where we have deep blocks. And I think the very first step in getting past those is what Liber Reish gives us with our regular daily four times a day recitation of it. With whatever adoration we have been taught, and hopefully at least one or two times when we actually sit down and meditate for a while on what has come up.
Do you feel like this kind of feels like the point where we're getting everything in that we want to say, but I don't know if there's more that you wanted to, because it looks like we got about 3 minutes, so this could be a good opportune time to wrap up, or we could stop and start back up again. How do you feel?
I don't really have anything specific in mind to do on liberation at this point.
Perfect. I'm going to take just that sentence, and that'll be the entire episode right there. Our first 30-second episode. The intro will be longer than the actual content.
But one of these days, we're going to do one about the whole thing of men were made to love one another and to hate one another.
Yeah.
And as I say, I think Raish is the first thing that brings out some of that.
Mm-hmm.
Learning one of the pentagram rituals, whether it's the lesser ritual or the pentagram or the star ruby, you're learning to banish that stuff and push it away and lift your mind out of that. Raish, I found, was annoying enough that it actually brought out the stuff that was important to understand for the future.
Great. Well, thanks very much once again. Love is the law. Love under will.
Love is the law. Love under will.
Thanks for listening. Find Toronto Philema online. Like, comment, share, and subscribe, and help us grow. And join us again in the darkly splendid abodes.